Hello and welcome back to the Album Files podcast. We are a little bit late and it is probably my fault, but we're here with another episode for you all. Our second episode of the year. Today we're going to talk about Green Day's American Idiot. Before we dive into that, I'm joined by Ian Treloar.
Hello, bicycle friends. And
how do you pronounce your last name? Because I said Treloar, but I feel like somebody on a recent work call, as we all work at the same place, said trailer.
Well, that's like profoundly wrong. Yeah. Who said that?
I don't remember. But I remember hearing it in the business update call and being like, have I been saying his name wrong this entire time?
I think that Kaylee's quite bad at pronouncing my name, if it was Kaylee.
I like to call him Lane Trailer just for a bit of fun.
Mm.
But
yeah.
It wasn't you.
I like to call you lots of things for fun, Matt.
It is. It is true. It is very true.
Treloar. Treloar will do.
Okay, I'm glad because it's been in the back of my mind since Thursday and I've been stressed about it.
I'm sorry to haunt you with my mysterious name.
Matt Deneef.
Hello, I'm also here. How are you going?
Because we failed to record a podcast in a timely manner, we do actually have exciting things to talk about and super sad things to talk about before we talk about Green Day. And that's that Boy Genius announced that they are going on an indefinite hiatus, which is just devastating. But I feel like it was so much of a good thing that there's no way that it was going to last.
I think that there's too much sorrow about this because it was like 3 years or something between the EP and the album. And nobody batted an eyelid about that. They've done touring and they've done support acts for Taylor Swift and all sorts behind the record. They've won a load of awards.
Technically, that was just Phoebe Bridgers opening for Taylor Swift and she brought them with her.
And I think that they're each of them overdue a solo album of their own and a touring cycle behind it. So I wouldn't be surprised if in 2 years' time, or probably longer, because Phoebe Bridgers' next album is going to be massive because she's massive. But I reckon that 2 or 3 years from now, there'll be another record and then all will be fine and dandy. They're just managing expectations, Abby.
Yeah, but when has a band ever said, we're going on hiatus? This is actually a bad sentence to finish because I'm going to talk about a band that went on hiatus and came back in a couple minutes. But it's rare that a band goes on hiatus and actually comes back. I feel like we're going on an indefinite hiatus is code for we're breaking up, but we don't want to make drama and say that we're breaking up.
But there's
so we're going to say that we're going on hiatus.
There's obviously a lot of respect between them and they all love each other very much and they're good mates and I don't get any sense of drama. So I think that...
What I would say is that the term indefinite hiatus is the ultimate amount of freedom that you can give as an explanation. It allows them to do whatever they want. Whereas if they say we're, you know, we might come back or whatever, you kind of open the door for speculation. I think this just kind of gives them the choice to do whatever they want from here, whatever the explanation might be.
Speaking of doing whatever you want, Taylor Swift broke Grammy rules last weekend, and announced a new album, a brand new album, not a re-record, a new album, which you're not allowed to do at the Grammys, but Taylor Swift's gonna Taylor Swift. I think we were all expecting, we all being myself, Reputation to be the next album that she was going to release. But instead, we're getting a brand new album, I assume with Aaron Dessner and Jack Antonoff, because she's been spotted. Aaron posted photos of her recording in the studio a couple months ago, so everyone's kind of assumed that that's going to be the vibe of the album, and the name of the album kind of hints toward that as well, Matt.
Do we know for sure that it is going to be her next album? I know she said that it's coming out, but do we know for sure that she isn't just going to one day drop Reputation TV out of nowhere?
Why would you put that out into the universe?
I mean, that's a possibility, right? It's very much in her range to just be like, right, tomorrow this is coming out, or next week this is coming out. There's still plenty of time between now and April whenever that this new album's coming out.
I mean, you're not wrong at all. So maybe there is still a chance that Rep TV is the next thing that she's going to release. But I feel like that would be a stretch. Like, she's unhinged, but I do feel like that would be a stretch.
I don't think it's very fair, Matt, to send Abby spiraling like this. with more speculation and lobbing the possibility of another album onto her plate.
Well, if I can just make this even more distressing, I'd just like to resurface our discussion from earlier about the title of the album and the fact that...
I was going to go into
please,
that.
Please, please, you do it, Abby.
Yeah, the title of the album is The Tortured Poets Department. The immediate reaction from, well, Matt and I, and maybe also Ian. No, Ian, you were fine with it?
I mean, I think it's a little bit overwrought, but...
Yeah, is the title of this album grammatically correct?
Yeah,
it's all in the placement of the apostrophe, and that is what we were back and forth about.
Yeah, but there's no apostrophe.
There is no apostrophe.
There's no apostrophe.
Matt would like an apostrophe.
So
I would like an apostrophe. I can understand why there isn't one. I think it's cleaner without it, but it makes me twitch a little bit not seeing one in there. But I think you could probably defend it. I know there's probably somebody who's much better at style stuff listening to this that can tell us once and for all why there doesn't need to be an apostrophe there, but I read it and I certainly go, it'd be nice to have one in there.
And I was shocked to learn that Abby felt the same.
It was the first thing I thought upon reading the name when I woke up this morning, which means that Matt and Dane have rubbed off on me. Mostly Dane.
I feel like normally I've got a pretty good handle on where apostrophes go and my grammar, and I like to think that I file pretty clean copy, but the fact that this just like passed right through to the keeper and I didn't even notice that there was a problem with an apostrophe or that there was an apostrophe missing at all made me feel that I was impressed with Abby. I was impressed with Matt.
Well, and if there's anybody listening that has a better explanation for why or why not an apostrophe should be in there, please let us know. I'm intrigued. I feel like it could go either way. And I was just going to highlight how cool we are that the first thing we started talking about when a new Taylor Swift album was announced was the grammar of the title of it.
I don't know if I like the title of the album, to be honest. I mean, I feel like it's a mouthful. It doesn't roll off the tongue. It's not. Yeah. I don't know. But it's 2 years in the making, which is 18 months longer than, I'm assuming, Folklore and Evermore. So if she is indeed working with Aaron Dessner and Jack Antonoff on this album and they got that much more time to work on it, it's either going to be like mind-blowing or it's going to be...
Can I get you to just wheel yourself over to the pin board that you've got behind you with all of the bits of red string and just triangulate for us where in the recording process of Midnights and Evermore this one would sit if it's 2 years in the making. Does that mean it is from those that era with Dessner and Antonoff, or does it come after that?
No, I think it started whilst they were, like, after they re-recorded, or after they recorded Evermore, whilst they were re-recording Red Taylor's version, I think, is when they probably would have started to work on it. And then in the process of her also re-recording Speak Now, 1989, and making Midnights, which I think Midnights she made quite quickly, that it came, it's been a slow process of making it while also working on all the other stuff and doing a tour and writing a novel and creating her first major motion picture.
And also all of these things, also being like a mouthpiece for Joe Biden and making all of the...
Yeah, that takes up a lot of time for her. Obviously, she's spent so much time talking about Joe Biden.
Yeah.
0 minutes.
Okay, cool. All right. So that's where we place it. Cool.
Yeah. I also feel like before we actually get into the actual bulk of the episode, we should also mention that she won the Album of the Year for Midnights at the Grammys over the weekend. And I personally don't think that if she's been snubbed before, and should she be the record holder for the most albums of the year won? Absolutely, but it should have been Red. So I don't know if, like, Midnights, I don't think maybe deserved this win, but she did win, and that means that she has the most Album of the Year awards of anyone ever, male or female, which is pretty cool.
Four, right? So yep. Fearless, 1989, Midnights, and Folklore.
I feel like Evermore and Red were maybe more deserving of the of winning, but not Evermore because that year was a tough, that there was just some really good albums that year. But for me, I feel like Guts or The Record were probably more deserving of winning album of the year this year. I also feel like if you win album of the year, you should be automatically disqualified from the other categories of the album of the year categories. Like the fact that she won album of the year and pop album of the year leaves a bad taste. Like she could have won album of the year and then like Olivia Rodrigo should have won pop album of the year, for example.
But yeah. Yeah. Oh, Ian, just a question for you. Have you listened to Olivia Rodrigo's Guts yet?
Bits and pieces.
Oh, really? Just by accident? Yeah,
I like the little devilish smile that came over your face there where you were like, I know that this is some homework he hasn't done, but I kind of have.
It's like a 35-minute album, mate.
Yeah, well, I've listened to probably half of it and some of the songs more than once.
Okay, wandering around the shops listening to songs on the radio, that doesn't count.
No, intentional listening. I went to Bunnings, I put it on, and then I paused it whilst I went and got some cat food, and then I kept listening, and the Bunnings is not particularly far away from home, and then I got distracted.
On top of listening to Boy Genius because they, yeah, indefinite hiatus, and so I've been sad listening. I've also been listening to a lot of Renee Rapp. She performed on SNL. She's in the new Mean Girls musical movie that came out recently as Regina George. And I've kind of like noticed her music before, but I think I tried to listen to Snow Angel, her first like studio release big album. On the first listen, I was like, it's not for me. And then I saw her perform on SNL, which apparently is how I learn about a lot of artists. And she was great. And so I started listening to her EP, her like, I can't remember when she released it. I think it would have been 2021 maybe. And there's a song on there called Colorado that I just really love, but most of the EP I really liked. And so I've been listening to Renee Rapp on repeat.
I have not heard of her at all.
You guys got any? She reminds me a bit of like Olivia Rodrigo, actually. Like there's a couple songs on Snow Angel, her album, that I think like could be sued for copyright. But she's really talented. So
oh, I look forward to listening to some of those when you put them in the playlist that accompanies this episode. I listened a couple of times to Green Day's latest album in preparation for this week's episode. The new album's called Saviors, and it's so good. It's really, really good. I won't say too much about it because I feel like a lot of the praise I have for it is very similar to what I like about American Idiot, but I couldn't really find a bad song on there. I thought they were all really strong. Bobby Socks, I really liked. Dilemma, Father to a Son. It's just really strong, and I was surprised by that. I haven't listened to much Green Day, and getting back into it, you know, 20 years after American Idiot, I was very pleasantly surprised. I assume you've listened to it, Abby, given you were talking about it, I think, in a previous episode.
Yeah, I've listened to it a couple times, not nearly as much as I would like. I've been in like a female music mindset where like, yeah, Renee Rapp and Boy Genius and Last Dinner Party's album came out on Friday. So I was listening to that over the weekend, and a lot of the Chicks, formerly the Dixie Chicks, which I'll mention when I have my incredibly long rant about the album of the day, but so I haven't listened to it as many times as I would like. I definitely want to dive into it more, I think, when I'm feeling it a bit more, because it's hard to just listen to Green Day, I feel like. it's easy to listen to them in one way, but I feel like I'm not gonna like put it on with Lila while we're making dinner and stuff. And I could listen to it on the bike or running, but I can't really listen to it in the car for some reason. So I think I just have to find the right moment.
Yeah, worth doing, I reckon, and listen to it loud if you can.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that, because the review on, I think it was Pitchfork, was they hated it.
Really? I'm surprised. It's very solid.
Like, hated it.
There's also a really cool video that came out from, I can't remember, Jimmy Fallon's show. I can't remember the name of it. Apologies. But Green Day doing a New York subway gig in disguise.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. Well, I saw a TikTok of somebody who was like trying to take the subway, and then they panned over it. It was performing in the subway.
It's very cool. It's well worth a look. They start off by playing a different song, which I wasn't familiar with it, but with Jimmy Fallon playing as well, and then they kind of reveal the surprise, and then Green Day play I think Basket Case, but it's very, very cool.
I like it when I think there was one time actually with Taylor Swift that he had her in the subway as well, but like in disguise. And then she did what she does in the Fearless tour, where she has the clothes, like outer clothes, ripped off, and she's got a sparkly dress and like ripped her wig off, and it was Taylor Swift. Back then, like a little bit less of a reaction, I think. Now, if she did that, the subway would come crashing
shut down for the day, right?
It's like the world would end. But he does that like often. It's pretty cool. I like it.
Also, Billy Joe Armstrong looks amazing for 51, just as a side note.
He does not look like he's aged today.
No, it's crazy.
Ian, what about you? You got any recent listenings?
I do. I have been listening to, there's a Japanese post-rock band that I know Matt likes called Mono. I came across a live album of theirs called Beyond the Past, and that's live with an orchestra, and that's really, really, really good. It's kind of drawing on lots of stuff throughout their career. They've been around for a while, and they've got a lot of albums, so that's really, really good. I have also been listening to, I often listen to this band, but I've been listening to them a bit more, a band called Violet Cold. Which is a one person, I don't know, like, you know, the kind of bullshit that I listen to, like black metal cross with shoegaze kind of stuff. But because it's a one person project from Azerbaijan, there's a lot of interesting Middle Eastern influences in there as well. And also some dance music kind of stuff woven in. So he has an album called Magic Night, which is quite old now, 6 or 7 years, but that's quite an appealing one to listen to because it doesn't have any screamed vocals or anything like that. It's just an instrumental album, so it's almost post-rock. And besides that, a Russian two-piece black metal shoegaze band called Ulhava, they have a new album called...
Oh, this is the bit.
What do you mean? Oh, this is not the bit. No.
It's unrelated to the bit?
This is unrelated to the bit. The call started with me talking to Abby and pretending that I was a telemarketer from Belarus.
Which is just a perfectly normal thing to do.
It's actually like pretty par for the course for me. and then Matt dialed in and was just like, right, no, I'm not having any of this. And was very unhappy within about 20 seconds of the call starting. Abby was quite pleased with it, but who among us doesn't like to do little accents and play characters? Okay, so all of the hands are up. Cool. Anyway, Ulhava, they have... they seem to have an album that comes out every, I don't know, 6 months or every year or something. They're quite prolific. And their new one is really, really good. So that is what I've been listening to.
Ooh, cracking of the knuckles, stretching. Big monologue coming up.
Yeah. Okay. So I picked Green Day's American Idiot for this chapter of our podcast story. Green Day, the American rock band out of East Bay, the San Francisco area, California, was formed by Billy Joe Armstrong and Mike Dirnt when they were 15, still in high school. They formed a band originally called Blood Rage, and then they changed it to Sweet Children, which they later changed to Green Day, which is slang for when you spend the whole day smoking weed. A few years after the band formed, they started with some other members, but a few years after the band formed, it was just the two of them and Trey Cool, who came in to play drums. The band formed in 1987, and their first major label album debut was Dookie on February 1st of 1994. It was considered hugely successful in large part thanks to MTV. At the time, they were playing the music videos on repeat on MTV, back when it was music videos only, and they gained a lot of traction there. They were part of the popularization of punk rock that started in the U.S. thanks to Bad Religion, The Offspring, Social Distortion, and bands like that. But their next few albums after Dookie were not as successful. They released those over like 1995, 1997, 2000s. But it was when they released the rock opera that is American Idiot, their seventh studio album in 2004, that they really gained traction as a band. It's not their best-selling album. That came next, the 21st Century Breakdown, which was released in 2009. But American Idiot was definitely, I think, the album that put them on the map. Like, Dookie was successful, but American Idiot kind of broke the norm, and I think became popular in different to a different audience with that album. Their next chunk of albums, which was a trilogy called Uno, Dos, Tres, like the drummer, were not as successful, and they've kind of fallen off the map since 21st Century Breakdown. Like Matt said, they released their latest album January of this year, so just a couple weeks ago. The three members of the band have all done solo stuff as well, and they've been parts of other bands. So in the years since they released their most successful albums, they've all gone on to do other things. But in terms of American Idiot, it became a Broadway adaptation in 2010 and was nominated for 3 Tony Awards: Best Musical, Best Scene Design, and Best Lighting Design. The band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2015, the first year that they were eligible to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The album itself won Best Rock Album at the 2005 Grammys, and Boulevard of Broken Dreams won Record of the Year that year as well. It was originally supposed to be called Cigarettes and Valentines, but the original masters for the recordings were stolen from the studio, and the band decided that instead of trying to recreate what they'd already done, that they were going to start from scratch. Because of that, the album turned into a concept album that follows a character, Jesus of Suburbia, a lower middle class American teen, through a kind of coming of age in an America post 9/11 and during the Iraq War. The album has a lot of themes of disillusionment of the generation of American youth that the three members of the band kind of grew up in. And it was very much a response to George W. Bush as the president during this time. And it was kind of a dig at, quotes, America, at the time when they wrote it. Unintentionally, perhaps, the album became a statement about how the music industry and the world at large reacts to men versus women. This is my personal take that I've, having been a longtime fan of the Dixie Chicks, the Chicks. The album came out actually 1 year after the Chicks were pretty much blackballed from music because of one comment made by their lead singer at a gig in London. She said that she was, basically she said that she was bummed that the president, George W. Bush, came from Texas and didn't agree with the war. And because of that, the Dixie Chicks were blackballed from radio, blacklisted from, like, they lost sponsorship, they lost deals, their ticket sales plummeted, their album sales plummeted, and Even though they released a hugely successful album, Taking the Long Way, after that incident, they ended up going on hiatus because they just couldn't really get any traction. They returned in 2016 for a tour and then eventually changed their name to The Chicks in 2020 because of the George Floyd, because of the Black Lives Matter movement that was happening in 2020 and everything that was going on that summer. They changed their name to The Chicks because Dixie is has relation to slavery, so they cut that out of the name and released their Gaslighter album in 2020. But the whole point of that rant was the reaction that happened for The Chicks versus what happened to Green Day when they released this album. They got more popular for this album and The Chicks were basically blacklisted. And I think a lot of that has to do with the type of music that they're making. Obviously, like, punk rock is not something that, if they're going to speak out against the government, their audience is probably more likely to listen, versus The Chicks were country and it was very much the country scene that kind of tanked their career in a way. But I do think that it's worth pointing out because the whole album is basically ripping apart the American dream of American Idiot, and The Chicks only made one comment. That was a weird side tangent, but I wanted to throw it in there. When they were making American Idiot, they spent 5 months living in a hotel in Hollywood where they recorded the album. They took a really relaxed approach to recording compared to other albums that they've made. And in all, it took 10 months to make. There's actually a documentary that follows the whole process of making the album called Heart Like a Hand Grenade. Because of the concept of the album, the band experimented with long chaptered compositions like Jesus of Suburbia, which is 9 minutes long and is broken into 5 chapters. And also Homecoming, which is also 9+ minutes long and broken into 5 chapters. In an interview, Armstrong talked about abandoning the verse, chorus, bridge song structure and how that opened up the band's ability to experiment with writing. And it was incredibly well received. I picked this album personally because, apart from the fact that I love it, and in a lot of ways it was the first album that I fell in love with completely separate from my family, listening to music with my parents and growing up, it also feels oddly like too close to the current political climate of America. John Colapinto of Rolling Stone wrote that this album gives voice to the disenfranchised suburban underclass of Americans who feel wholly unrepresented by the current leadership of oilmen and Ivy Leagues, and who are too smart to accept the reality presented by news media who sell the government's line of fear and warmongering. And that was in 2004. So, chills. It's not really that different from the world that we're living in now. And in a lot of ways, it's gotten a lot worse. So I feel like listening to this album now with everything in mind that they were trying to create when they made this album and everything that's happening now is, a little bit depressing that we've not changed. It was an album that changed me as a person, as a freshman in high school, in a lot of ways. Listening to this album for the first time helped me discover who I was going to be. Funny enough, it was introduced to me by a band of 3 guys that I was just like madly in love with. 3 boys, a grade above me, that became my protectors in a lot of ways as a young girl in a school that I was ill-equipped to handle. And in a large part, this album was tied to my departure from youth and my, just becoming my own person separate from my parents' taste in music. So this album holds a lot of weight for me personally, and I've not listened to it in a really long time. My music tastes have branched out a lot since listening to this album as a 13-year-old, but I do think that it holds up in the themes of the album as a concept album and as like a journey that it takes you on. So holy shit, that was my rant.
Yeah, lots to digest there, Abby. Thank you.
Sorry.
I think no.
I don't know if that was too much information.
No, I mean that in a good way. Just a few things that stood out to me. I think you're talking about how it was very much a record talking about the times what was going on at the time, post 9/11 Iraq War, George W. Bush, that kind of stuff. Billy Joe Armstrong was quoted at the time saying that he wanted to write something about the climate they lived in, but hoped that it would be a record that would stand the test of time, I guess, and still be relevant years later. And, you know, as you've said there, I think he very much succeeded in that. It does feel very relevant even today. Just on the composition stuff, you know, the two kind of 9-minute multi-movement mini rock operas in Jesus of Suburbia and Homecoming, they were also born out of a new writing technique that the band used ahead of the album. So they came into this album having gone through a pretty rough period as a band where they very nearly broke up. They weren't working well together. Trey Cool and Mike Dirnt thought that Billy Joe Armstrong was too controlling as a frontman. And so in an attempt to work better together and be a bit more diplomatic, they each set about writing 30-second chunks of songs that they would then use, they would then bring into the studio and work together on. And a bunch of those would ultimately be combined into these longer songs that we end up hearing. So Homecoming was the first one they recorded. And in fact, you hear Trey Cool singing one movement of that, and you hear Mike Dirnt singing another movement of that song. And then they developed Jesus of Suburbia using the same technique later on in the writing process. And I think that's just really cool. It's a cool way that they were able to work well together. And I think for me, I mean, in an album full of absolute bangers, the Jesus of Suburbia is one of, if not the highlight on the album. And I love the places that it goes to and the way they're able to get there by combining a bunch of different flavors, I guess.
I was absolutely shocked when listening to this album in full for the first time in at least 14 years that I was able to remember every single lyric. Like I was listening to Jesus of Suburbia and I was singing along the whole time first listen through, which was wild to me. With a 9-minute song that changes 5 times throughout the song. I feel like those two songs in particular, like it's no surprise to me that Homecoming was the first one that they wrote of the two, because I feel like for me personally, I don't like that one as much. I feel like it feels really chaotic, yeah. Not in a good way, like this podcast, but it doesn't flow as well as Jesus of Suburbia. It just doesn't sound as good. It doesn't transition as well. There's just a lot going on, and it's like there's a lot going on, but it's not cleanly done. Whereas in Jesus of Suburbia, there's a lot going on, but it is so good, that song. Like every single transition from one chapter to another is good. They all fit together. It's just like such an amazing song and just so good. I love it so much. It's just, it's like a masterpiece, that song.
Yeah, it truly is. I wrote down here the two chapters in particular, the two movements, City of the Damned and Tales of Another Broken Home, are just utterly incredible. Like just, they hit so, so hard. And I was listening to this just before we recorded, actually, and I turned my headphones up quite a bit louder than I normally would to listen to this, it's absolutely worth it. If you haven't listened to this with headphones, I'd recommend doing it, and doing so loud, and those parts in particular. You're right about Homecoming. I think the transition that I noted in particular is from Rock and Roll Girlfriend into We're Coming Home Again. And it feels like they've kind of crowbarred those two sections in together, and they don't quite work. It's still good, but it's not Jesus of Suburbia, which is just from start to finish just incredible. And like you, Abby, I have a real nostalgia for this album. It came out in my final year of high school and it was absolutely everywhere. You know, the lead singles, American Idiot, Holiday, Boulevard of Broken Dreams, and to a lesser extent, Wake Me Up When September Ends, were just absolutely everywhere. You couldn't escape them. And in some ways, I was a bit worried listening to this again so many years later that I would find it difficult to separate the listening experience from almost the cultural background at the time, because they were just so, to me anyway, they were just so omnipresent. But I was really glad that I was able to do that. And I probably hadn't listened to this for 15 years either. And man, it just really holds up. But the reason I bring up that nostalgia thing is I have really strong memories of being in the, you know, the downstairs area at our childhood home, and my two brothers and I playing Jesus of Suburbia together, me playing guitar and singing, my brother Ash playing bass, and my brother Brennan playing drums. And I'm sure if we had a recording of that somewhere, it would be awful. I know for a fact the vocal is much, much too high for me, but they're some of the most treasured memories I have of musical memories, certainly, and probably growing up, just that, just playing that song and just enjoying that experience of playing along with them. And oh man, it's just such a good song. I do have more I want to talk about this album, but I'm keen to hear from Ian, because I feel like he hasn't got a word in yet.
I love hearing from you guys about like your childhood, or not childhood, like teen recollections of music and early adulthood. I think it's such a precious thing.
Another fun one for you. I'll jump in with another fun one then that you'll really enjoy.
Yeah,
just really quickly. There's a live recording of this album. The name of it escapes me at the moment, but they recorded a live version, and my brothers and I were watching it. And I remember our mum walking into the room, and this was very much in Billie Joe Armstrong's thick black eyeliner era. And I remember her walking into the room and being like, "Oh, he's really cute. That looks great on him, that eyeliner." And then just walking out of the room, and we're all just kind of like, "Oh,
mom.
Okay, cool. Thanks, mom. Cool." Continue, Ian.
Oh, that's amazing. So for me, this came out in my second last year of high school, because I am slightly younger than Matthew and slightly older than Abby, and because I was full blown art pop wanker and indie rock guy, continue to be. No, I've branched out into obscure black metal now, Matt.
That's right. Yep. It's even more of an art pop wanker. Got it. Keep going.
Yeah, that's true. So all of the, like, this was obviously a massive album. It was number one in Australia. A bunch of the songs were mainstream hits. And I think that what Abby, you were saying, like, it's kind of like this crossover moment from them being a punk band that punk kids listen to a mainstream punk band that everyone listens to. Like, I was out the other night at a pub and some guy's just wearing an American Idiot t-shirt. Like, it's clearly an enduring album and an enduring band. And
did you tell him about the podcast?
No. I was talking about the podcast to someone that I was with, and I was like, I'm not going to talk too loudly because there's a man on the next table wearing the t-shirt. But anyway, so I think that for something that was such a big piece of the sort of cultural landscape, especially when you're in late high school and you've got like the emo kids and the punk kids, and this is an album that was very much on everyone's radar, whether they're from that sort of crowd or whether they're just listening to mainstream radio because Boulevard of Broken Dreams, Wake Me Up When September Ends, these are songs that are just a big deal. So I guess where I'm going with that is that I was aware of Green Day and I was aware of songs of this album, but I never really listened to it as a concerted effort until a couple of weeks ago. So that is my background on Green Day. And I was really pleasantly surprised. Like, it's not really my kind of thing necessarily, but the songs are really solid. I think that there's incredible songwriting craft on display and just amazing choruses that just hit really hard. Like Holiday, it's just this massive chorus. Boulevard of Broken Dreams, massive chorus. There's so many sort of endorphin hits from things that are really, yeah, like it's stuff that's just really pleasant to listen to and that you enjoy listening to. Jesus of Suburbia is such a well-constructed song with those five movements flowing really beautifully into each other. One thing that I was a little... there were certain bits that didn't feel like it was entirely original work, like the second movement of Jesus of Suburbia has a pretty heavy Summer of 69 by Bryan Adams influence to it. Like, it's the same melodic line. Same thing on She's a Rebel. Same melody as the Christmas Carol, Do You Hear What I Hear? I'm not sure if...
yeah, right.
But when I heard it, I was just like, that is exactly the same melody. Come on, guys. But I really enjoyed listening to this album. I was very confused listening to this album as well when I was on Spotify, and on Spotify it's got 9 tracks, and then the track listing that I'm looking at now has 13, I think.
Yeah,
so it was a little bit hard to work out where that... I don't know why they presented it or why they packaged it in different ways for different platforms. But yeah, for whatever reason, on Spotify, there's 4 songs which are like slashies, like 2 songs stitched together, which makes it a little bit...
Yeah, I had that down as one of the few frustrations I had with the album. I can only imagine it's a narrative thing, like they wanted to group those songs more closely together, but I find it very frustrating. I think if you wanted to go and listen to Boulevard of Broken Dreams, the fact you have to listen...
You just want to listen to that song.
Yeah, yeah. You don't have to go through Holiday to get there, although Holiday is a banger.
Mm.
Yeah, I find it a bit strange. I can't see any downside to just breaking them up into their separate tracks, but there's probably a reason. There's probably some explanation out there somewhere.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Mm.
I enjoyed it more than I was expecting to, because I think I'd kind of written it off 20 years ago as just not really being my kind of thing, and found that it was more than I expected it to be.
One thing I really wanted to highlight was the contrast between this album and Bat Out of Hell that we did last time. So both are rock operas, in a sense. One of them is very bombastic and weird in its structure, being Bat Out of Hell. The way the songs are crafted is very, very unusual. And this one, while they did break away from the, you know, verse-chorus bridge structure in some cases, this is still musically a lot simpler than Bat Out of Hell. And I would argue that it is actually quite simple music in a lot of ways. If you break it down, a lot of what they're doing is power chords, quite simple rhythms. And listening to this again has been a really strong and welcome reminder of the beauty of simplicity in that way, because I think that it shows that you don't need to be overcomplicated with the ingredients that you're pulling together to create something. I think if you, even the most simple of power chords and the most simple of melodies, if you add great vocal melodies over the top and you combine that with a really strong vocal and a whole lot of passion behind it, you get something that's quite incredible. And one of the abiding memories I have of playing Jesus of Suburbia in, you know, the downstairs area at my childhood home was how simple it was to play. Like if you've ever picked up a guitar, one of the first things you'll play is power chords, particularly electric guitar. They're very easy to play, and the song is basically all power chords the whole way through, and that's true for most of the album. And I think there is an element of musical snobbery both among professional musicians and among anyone that calls himself a musician. And I know that I am guilty of, when I'm writing stuff, kind of chastising myself for not doing stuff more complicated, or not challenging myself and falling back on the same 3 chords or the same power chords or the same whatever. And in a lot of ways, what they're doing here is quite derivative and quite basic, but it's crafted in such a way, and the songs are arranged in such a way, and the dynamics are such that unless you kind of know that, or you know what's going on, or you try and play it, you probably wouldn't notice it. And I just think it's a beautiful thing that sometimes just stripping things back to their simplest form is just incredibly effective. And this, yeah, the result here is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, there's very few misses on this album for me other than Homecoming. I still feel like if you put Homecoming into the grand scheme of this album and what it became, it still holds a lot of weight. But I there's not really much that I can criticize about this album, even if, yeah, it's not the most complex thing you've ever seen in your life.
One criticism I would have is the choice of final track.
Exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah. So I would have... And again, I assume this comes down to narrative reasons. I assume that What's Her Name needs to be the final track to wrap up the narrative arc. But it's actually quite a big anticlimax, I find, after this huge build of Homecoming, this 9-minute epic, to then go into What's Her Name, which feels probably the album at its most basic, is that the start of that next song where you've just got this very simple drum beat, very simple guitar riff. And it does get better from there. Like, the chorus hits really hard when the guitars come in, and it's great. But flipping the order of those would have made a big difference, I think.
The reasoning for What's Her Name being the final song is because in the concept of the album, the coming of age of Jesus of Suburbia, he meets two other characters throughout the narrative, and that's Saint Jimmy and What's Her Name, which she doesn't have a name, but she's introduced in She's a Rebel. And the whole point of What's Her Name being the final track is that Jesus of Suburbia has worked through this coming of age and has grown to the point where by the time we get to the end of the album, he can't even remember what her name was. But I agree, like, as a song on an album, it is not a great end. But in the narrative arc of the Broadway musical, perhaps it makes more sense.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance though, isn't it? Like, I can understand that, and I think that makes complete sense. But it does harm the album, I think. It does leave you feeling like the album wasn't as strong as it probably could have been if it had finished with Homecoming.
I also think that the concept for me didn't really land. Like, as a collection of songs, great. As something that I felt that I was following a narrative through from start to finish. Maybe it's that I haven't spent enough time with it and I've not dug into the lyrics enough. But I think that each of the songs stands pretty well on its own and you can kind of follow what's going on. But I don't feel that it creates a broader narrative all that well, for me at least. So I guess reinforcing what you said, Matt, that having that song on the end feels like it's tying a bow that I didn't really feel like needed tying because I didn't really think that there was a bigger structure at play behind it. And I don't think it necessarily did. I mean, if there's a musical, you've got actors, you've probably got dialogue between songs or whatever. To bolster that, but I think that if you come to it as just a sequence of songs, I don't really see how there's much of a thread tying them together other than like disenchantment with youth, which is, you know, just standard punk fare,
standard life.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I wish we could do like a podcast outing to see the musical. That'd be wild.
It would be fun. We should go and see musicals.
See any musicals. I don't think this is out in the world anymore, but they'll make it into a movie, surely.
Well, someday. If you read the Wikipedia page, they actually worked on it for, it must have been like a decade. They were talking about it on and off and it never happened in the end, but yeah, there was very much a plan to do it. And one thing I was going to say about that final track, it kind of reminded me of... There's a Australian band I've talked about a few times, the Smith Street Band. And one of, for me, their best album, More Scared of You Than You Are of Me, that ends with this two-song sequence where you have this really big, raucous, big finale track that's actually the penultimate track, and then the final track is a much lower tempo kind of... It feels like a strange choice, basically. And the way that the frontman, Will Wagner, explained it was he wanted it to be like going to a film and you see, you know, the closing scenes, and then the final track is kind of the, you know, the credits rolling or whatever. It's kind of the aftermath, if you like. And I wonder if we could look at that in the same way with What's-Her-Name, whether that's kind of like you see Homecoming as the climax of the thing, and then What's-Her-Name is the kind of end credits or whatever. I don't know if that helps to kind of contextualize it at all, but yeah, I still think it probably the album suffers slightly as a result of it.
I just dropped a link for you guys, the full Broadway production of American Idiot.
Oh, wow.
Are we having a listening party?
<You're> Yeah.
This is going to be the longest episode of the album files ever because we're just going to be giving live commentary as we watch a YouTube video.
That would actually be a hilarious podcast, and I think we would even lose my mom in that process.
Oh.
Do we want to run through like our favorite tracks and then wrap up the episode?
Let's do it.
I feel like most of the tracks I love. I already talked about Homecoming, and I think the only other track that doesn't hit for me is probably Letterbomb. I think my favorite tracks, apart from Jesus of Suburbia, Boulevard of Broken Dreams is amazing. Give Me Novocaine, Wake Me Up When September Ends. Like, they're so good.
Yeah, that's very similar to my list as well. I think the title track is great. Jesus of Suburbia is incredible. Holiday, Boulevard of Broken Dreams, Give Me Novocaine, Letterbomb I quite like, Wake Me Up When September Ends. Yeah, there's no really bad songs on here. I don't like What's-Her-Name as much, but it's still good. Like I said, the when the guitars come in, oof, it's still pretty strong.
For me, Jesus of Suburbia is the standout. Holiday, Boulevard of Broken Dreams. I quite like She's a Rebel, Wake Me Up When September Ends. Bits of Homecoming, not all of it. Yeah, I think it's a there's a lot to like.
I'm kind of pleasantly surprised that the singles from the album still stand up. I feel like I heard them so much at the time that I was really worried I really wouldn't want to listen to them. But they're just so good, just so strong. Boulevard of Broken Dreams, I think, particularly for me, where I don't know how many times I would have heard that song, but as you said, Ian, the chorus is just so strong, and that outro riff, the heavy riff, is just so good. So I'm really glad that those songs still hold up 20 years later. Wow, 20 years, that's scary. And even more glad that the whole album is as good as I remember it to be.
But I think that like time moves at different paces depending on where you are in your life. Like, this was so ubiquitous when we were 18, 19, whatever. And then radio play or whatever would have dropped off fairly quickly. But then that period from your late teens to mid-20s or whatever, everything is so... You consume everything so hungrily, and then I think you kind of slow down on that when you get into that next decade. So you're right, it's been like 20 years since that time. So I don't know when I would have last heard any of those songs. Probably 10, 15 years ago that they were last getting big airplay, and we just remember them as being these songs that were absolutely everywhere. But when did we last hear them? So they do hold up really well. I agree with you. And it's really exciting to listen to them again after all that time, because it does conjure those memories, and it makes you think this is something that I'm familiar with, but the details are hazy enough that it allows you to see it again in a fresh light and remember that it is what you remembered, but it's probably better.
Yep, I'd agree with that.
We want to rate it. Ian, you want to go first?
I'll go straight down the line, 7.
Matt?
It's tricky, isn't it? I'm going to say 9.2 out of 10.
Whoa.
It's a banger. Actually, no, I'm going to say 9. So I'm going to just dial that back. I'm going to say 9. What were you saying, Abby?
Devoted. Yeah. 9.8 for me. Almost perfect.
4.
Love it.
Yep.
Loved coming back to it.
Yeah.
Loved chatting about it with you guys.
Thanks for bringing it back.
Matt came in with more knowledge, more succinctly than I did.
I had the luxury of being able to follow you and just cherry pick some things to add. You know, you had to do the heavy lifting.
Marie, my wife, is listening in the room next door.
Oh, you said it normally that time.
My wife. Yeah. And she just sent me a message saying you're sleeping outside. She's a big fan of this album and was like, you'd better give it a high rating.
So. You know what? I get along with you guys and I think you guys are super cool, but I feel like if we lived in the same place, your wives would be my best friends.
I think they probably feel similarly.
Ian, can you just quickly ask Marie what she would rate this album out of 10, please?
Should I just yell, like...
Do it, yeah.
Like Napoleon Dynamite, like, into the next room. Tina, come get some ham.
Oi, Marie! What do you rate it?
Marie, what do you rate it? Too much pressure now, she says. She gives it a 10.
Wow.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Go, Marie. Love that.
That's a
we would totally
exceptionally
be
high score. It cannot possibly be higher. It's maximum score.
Between her and I, mutual music appreciation, and Imo and I have the same taste in books, it seems like, that I think we would just, it would be a great friendship, man.
You just need to move to Melbourne. Get it
lost
done.
Lost opportunities. Yeah. Well, for the next episode, we're doing our listener picks, and we got some amazing ones. We got a ton in this time. It's really cool to see. Since Ian, I believe you put together this beautiful spreadsheet of all of them. I added one more at the bottom from my mom because she texted it to me and did not put it on social media.
Great.
It's probably not one that either of you want to pick.
No. I have plenty of time for unnamed Swedish pop band.
So we're gonna, instead of drawing them out of a hat like we did last time, we're still gonna do 3 albums, 1 album each, but we're going to pick them off the list ourselves.
Oh,
who wants to go first?
Oh, can I ask who color coded? So I've color coded. Did you color code, Abby?
I've also color coded. Yeah. Okay.
There are some very good suggestions in here, and we kind of touched on it, but thank you to everybody that took the time to respond. Like, it's so cool, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, there are 41 albums that people have suggested for us to listen to, which is
that's wow. Like one per listener incredible. That we have. That's incredible.
Yeah, yeah, seriously. That's amazing. Okay, so I'm picking for Matt then first.
Do it.
Okay, well then I'm going to pick, this seems like cheating, but I'm going to pick for Matt one that I also picked for myself. And that's Alt-J, An Awesome Wave, suggested by Brooke.
Ian, for you, I'm going to choose Camp Cope's How to Socialize and Make Friends.
Great. I've never heard that album, and I'm excited to.
Yeah. What made you select it? What made you highlight it?
I feel like they're a band that I might have heard like one or two songs on Triple J or something, and I like the idea of it.
Okay. That suggestion came from Andy Jerry, so thanks for that, Andy.
Thanks, Andy. All right, and I am choosing for... Hang on, I've lost track. I'm choosing for Abby, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I'm choosing Japanese Breakfast.
Nice.
Jubilee.
Oh, sick.
By JLB, awesome. 1705. Whoever you are, wherever you are.
Whoever it is, they had some seriously awesome suggestions.
I would say that there
Paula
are
and
so,
Bridgers
many,
also?
So many song, so many albums that I wanted to dig into. And also Toops. Like, I felt that it would have been unfair to just inflict Def Heaven on you. But Toops had Sunny Day Real Estate, Fugazi, Burial, Hannah Nicklin, some great albums that I want to dig into, and I will. I'm really excited by some of this.
David Savage also recommended an album by Animals as Leaders, and I think inflicting that on you guys would be pretty fun. It's like very aggressive math rock. Very aggressive. Would have been quite funny.
I know that you you have a theory that my only band that I would not be happy about listening to is the Mars Volta, but Animals as Leaders are like on the cusp of that categorization.
Have you heard this stuff before?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty wild. I like it, but it's wild.
It's busy. Yeah. All right. I'm very excited by this selection.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll be back in 2 weeks to talk, well, barring family emergencies again, we'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about our three albums. Listener suggested albums.
Should we wrap this up with some feedback from a listener, Peter Guga, who sent in an audio
file?
Yes,
please. Wait, is it nice feedback?
I think it's nice feedback. He disagrees with something you said, but I think he has presented it in a very nice way, and he is a valued listener, and we appreciate his time and his effort.
He is one of the world's lovely men.
All right, so we'll close out the episode with an audio diary, and anyone can send us those audio diaries. If you listen to the podcast and you want to chip in, please feel free to do so. I hope we get a bunch of comments on this episode, because I hope that American Idiot resonated with more people than Matt and I, and Marie, Ian's wife.
My wife.
And thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
G'day Abby, Matt and Ian. Regular albumophile Peter Guga here. At Matt's invitation, I thought I might give you my perspective on your first pick of 2024, Meatloaf's 1977 album, Bat Out of Hell. I found it both fun and infuriating, the reason for that later, listening to you three discuss an album that I've listened to, whether I wanted to or not, countless times. I was a DJ on a Victorian country radio station when Bat Out of Hell was overwhelming the Australian album and singles charts. And despite not being a great Meatloaf fan, I was obliged to play the album's various cuts on high rotation. And when I say rotation, I mean just that. In those days, we still had to physically put a piece of vinyl onto a turntable and drop a needle into its grooves to get the music that those grooves contained onto the airwaves. It was therefore really interesting to hear at least two of you talking about songs you were listening to for the first time, and without the weight of the baggage that the whole Meatloaf Jim Steinman phenomenon created at the time. You inspired me to stream the entire album on my recent early morning drive back from the tour down under in Adelaide and listen to this magnum opus with fresh ears for the first time in 47 years. For me, I think the passage of time has been kindest to Two Out of Three Ain't Bad, which, while a hit at the time, might now be the album's best song. Despite all its grandiose pomposity, I think Meatloaf's vocal performance is staggering, especially on the opening 9¾-minute title track, and the closer, For Crying Out Loud, which is only a minute shorter. Thanks, Matt, for informing me that Todd Rundgren produced the album. I'd either forgotten that fact or at the time wasn't much interested in that sort of vital information. Apparently Rundgren took the project on because he thought Bat Out of Hell was a Bruce Springsteen piss take. The Born to Run influences passed me by at the time but are now pretty obvious, so much so that I went straight to Springsteen's debut, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, for my follow-up road trip album. But enough of all that. I've been skirting around the elephant in the album, which is, of course, the duet Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Abby's comments about it are the whole reason I'm boring you with my recollections from the land before woke. A lot of blame can be laid at the feet of me and my fellow middle-aged white males, Abby, but the sentiments portrayed in Paradise by the Dashboard Light aren't one of them. While adolescence is a distant memory, I don't think teenage sexual politics has changed all that much over the millennia, and that's what the song captures. I can tell you for a fact that it wasn't middle-aged men who rang me up begging me to play the song, but teenage girls. They identified strongly with the character and feelings singer Ellen Foley portrays so well, and many, I'm sure, on those hot summer nights would have willingly swapped places with her as she bargains with Meatloaf's character in a joint quest for paradise. As they sing, We were barely 17 and we were barely dressed. Anyway, while I've got your attention, I'd like to put forward a listener-suggested album for your consideration. It's by a band who also have a strong Todd Rundgren connection and have been around even longer than Meatloaf, but are still going strong. Sparks. In fact, many would say they're sounding and performing as well as they ever have. Given their huge body of work, it's hard to pick one Sparks album, but how about 2017's Hippopotamus? Cheers and keep them coming in 2024. Pete.